Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
And welcome back to Strength to Be Human. This is the interview segment. I have another wonderful guest, James Nettles. He's the author of Business Essentials for Writers. James, thank you very much and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You know me, it's always about scheduling, but I'm always blessed to have somebody new on the show and miraculously in my same time zone. So I'm more than blessed on this one.
Well, you know, it's always fun to be able to actually get up in the mornings and run on kind of a normal schedule. So that helps.
I hear you. Sometimes I'm doing these things at 11 at night. You just never know when you're doing one.
I've done plenty of those shows. Those are always fun.
My wife's like, what are you doing? I'm like, guess what? Indy is 10 and a half hours from here. This is the way it is.
I've got a couple of friends that do some very late night shows that I get pulled into every once in a while. So, yeah, that phone call. Hey, it's Saturday night at 10 o'clock. Are you free? Sure. Why not?
I expect it's going to happen, too, because part of the advertising for the show is not just word of mouth and internet. But sometimes, you know, you want to guest on some other shows and give them a hand. And sometimes it kind of gives you a little leg up on what you're doing in your shows that other audiences can know. So I'm gearing up for that as well.
It's always a fun part of the process.
So you're definitely a more unique interviewee in the sense that most of the ones I've been doing are literary in that they were poetry or fiction, a novelist, or I had a couple playwrights already, and a musical songwriter for playwriting and musicals. But it looks like you're more confined, I guess, recently to the nonfiction and doing this Business Essentials for Writings, where I guess you help folks understand how they can make their work sellable.
Well, it gets a little bit more expansive than that. So I started out in media a very long time ago, and I still do some writing and contributing in futurist spaces, technology spaces, privacy. I do a lot of speaking and talking about privacy, but I'm also a science fiction and fantasy author. I write that under James P. McDonald. Right now I've got three novels, a couple of novellas out there underneath that name. I've got a bunch more stuff being released later this year. I've got a new hard sci-fi that'll come out in 2020. Right now we've got a pretty hard publishing calendar for that. I'm also one of the founding partners for what's called Author Essentials, and Business Essentials for Writers is the first book we've published underneath that. And that's been a product of about 6 years worth of work. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of friends of mine that are writers, that are authors, everything from people who are trying to write their first book to New York Times bestsellers that have all helped review, contribute to, and help me cram everything into this book. And so while I write a lot from a business and entrepreneurial and technology standpoint, I also get to play in the fiction world. So I play with both sides, and I believe everybody needs to have that creative outlet. So,
well, that's definitely a first. You don't hear too much of that. Either they're on one side or the other. So that's great to know.
And that's part of the reason I wind up writing under multiple names, because a lot of the time, because I also do a lot of business and technology consulting work. So while it's not as true as it used to be, you know, if you're working on somebody's large project, they don't necessarily want somebody who's writing about, you know, God's monsters and project management. So,
gotcha. No, it makes sense then why you can use a pen name. Yeah, definitely. Keeping both worlds separate, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's always been I've never done much to hide it, but it's enough professional separation to give me plausible deniability.
Yeah, I like that. Because you know how science fiction is. It can be very hit and miss, and sometimes it's just a niche to what our audience likes that particular material, because it's no longer just a bunch of aliens and robots anymore. It can be very diverse, I've noticed.
Yeah, it is. And so when you get into writing in different spaces, especially if you start writing across multiple genres, it doesn't hurt to have a different pen name by genre as well. It does mean a little bit more work when you're blending your social media, when you're doing your branding, when you're doing all that kind of work. But it also still helps to say, yes, I'm the same author that does X, Y, and Z. But for example, I've got a friend of mine who does steampunk, does an urban fantasy series, and also writes in erotica. And so romance. I've got erotica friends as or writers in that space as well, which is always fun to go talk to them. I had the great joy of, not to go too far off track, I had the great joy of speaking before the Romance Writers of America here in Charlotte a couple of weeks ago. And that's a very diverse crowd of writers there, between everybody that's writing from everything from Harlequin to independent erotica writers. And you get a very diverse set of questions and very different viewpoints on how the branding should work, how the marketing should work, and all that. But anyway, I have a friend who does write, who writes romance, steampunk, science fiction, fantasy. She and her husband have got a couple of series going together, and they have a couple of different branded pen names. It's not that it's hidden, but that way you know what you're going to get out of the product. So if you're getting it under this name with these, you know, with these identities, you know pretty well what you're going to get, versus if you go to another identity, you know what you're going to get there. They do cross branding. There's nothing they're hiding saying, oh, no, I'm not that person. But what it is really much more about branding and telling people what they're going to get when they buy stuff written under that name.
Yeah, it makes sense to me if that's how you're willing to go about it, because it's a form of management.
And there's always people that'll say, well, if somebody can write romance, they can't write science fiction. Or if they can write this, they can't write that. And so, I mean, there can be sometimes biases amongst readers. I think that's gotten better over the years, but we still see a lot of that too.
Yeah, mainly because sometimes categories can be blurred. I had some guy talking the other day. He's like, yeah, I do paranormal science fiction. I'm like, what's that? He's like, yeah, spirits and spirituality is mixed in with science fiction and technology. And I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard that before, but I'm like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things that I think has been really good about the industry and about indie publishing, is that we've gotten somewhat now into spaces where we can get out of being in somebody's canned niche. Because if you're going with a big five, you're going to a mid-sized publisher, they've got to put out something they know is going to sell. Now, at the same time, you also know that if you put out 10 books, one of them, if you're lucky, is going to really hit. Two or three are going to earn out, and the rest are never going to go anywhere. And you kind of know that. You balance the portfolio. It's like any sort of other investment and risk. If you're going down the small publisher route, or you're going down the indie publisher route, you know, you're going to self-publishing, then you actually get a lot more latitude, and you can blend and mix genres and ideas and have a lot more fun there. The downside of it, too, is making sure that you still put the same level of effort in to get the quality out of the writing. And I think that's one of the big challenges we see from that indie space, and even that small publisher size space, is that blend between quality and getting that unique niche that you can play with. And that's true not only for nonfiction as well as fiction. I mean, so you can see people who are getting very creative, even in the nonfiction space, about how they reflect their work, their business, their personal lives. It all is opened up in a lot of very interesting ways. But we're now starting to see the industry mature enough so that all of the services are available to people who consciously decide that it's time to bring their work to that level and that quality.
Well, I don't think it's too much off the beaten track over here to ask, because we've talked about this a number of times on the show already, but it really appears to many writers that the major publishing industry is declining and almost evaporating, and they have to be taking more of a hands-on approach with their work. And I don't mean just in indie publishing. I mean just even in a self-publishing type of way. Is that really your experience as well?
It is. So, I mean, I have a number of friends who are all long-term trade published authors, you know, big five, even mid-cap, mid-size publishers. Well, what we see definitively now is a migration much towards the hybrid author. So if you can go with a traditional publisher, somebody that can put you in a bookstore, somebody who can put you and give you leverage into certain spaces, that helps catapult you to where that anything you publish is an indie basis or from a small publisher side, you really get a synergy where you make the money off of your own stuff and you get the publicity and the boost from your traditionally published stuff. So it's an interesting mix, but I think we're seeing more and more of the trade pub authors going the hybrid route because they see there's money there and they also see that they can get work out the door faster. And there's always that work that doesn't necessarily fit into a given publisher's niche. So if you've got somebody, for example, that is doing the paranormal science fiction where they've got, you know, the ghost ship, but it's in space or, you know, whatever the case may be. If they're working with a traditional, let's say, for example, Tor, if you're going to Tor, what they take and what they publish is very specific. If you go to Bain Books, they write military science fiction. If you have somebody that wants to stray off of that a little bit, Bain is not that likely to pick that up. So when you look at it, those kind of publishers in the genre and the niche, you have to understand who your publisher is and what they're buying, what their space is. And if you as a writer want to get outside of that space, you have to make a decision. Who are the publishers that will buy that work or license that work? Or does it make sense to take it on and do it yourself? And I think more and more people are seeing that it makes sense to have that hybrid approach. The main difference is this, is if you are going through and you're being traditionally published, even by a small true publisher, then when you go down that publication route, you've got somebody who is picking up most of the expenses of actually producing the work. And mainly they're going to look at you and say, go market, go sell. If you're doing it the indie publishing route, you have to remember you're now picking up all those expenses and all those business decisions, which means you also have to have those connections to find your cover artists and decide what is good cover art, what is good editing, what is good marketing, what do all of those things look like? Because now you're acting as not only the author, you're also acting as the publisher. So there's a lot of business decisions that have to be made there, and you have to separate yourself from that. I'm in a creative space where I'm writing, I'm producing, I'm doing all this fun stuff until you hit the point where I hate this work, I hate this book, I never want to write this again. And then when you get to that past that 80% mark, you're like, all right, I see the light at the end of the tunnel and it's not New Jersey or a train. Mm-hmm. You know, you get in there and you get the work knocked out, but then you get out of creative mode and you have to go to business mode and make those hard decisions about how much am I ready to invest in a cover? Who is my artist going to be? Are they able to reflect what I really want? And when you talk about editing, there are a lot of fabulous editors, even people that have worked for or even continue to work for some of the big fives that do independent auditing or editing. I'm very fortunate in the editors that I have and I've built relationships with. And you know, they brought a lot of my work in the fiction space up significantly versus some of the stuff I had published 30 years ago. That makes me feel only slightly old. But when you look at what we've got as an industry and a business, and self-pub is no longer carries the same kind of stigma it used to. If somebody can see you're being published through a traditional publisher and you have work that you're putting out of your own, you're creating a little bit higher standard there.
Yeah, I definitely see that's the case. I guess I'm just a little frustrated from some of the questions I get because I continue to talk with writers that, I don't know, they seem to have a 1950s idea about how publishing actually works, even today, and they don't seem to understand that they need to have a marketing plan, even if they're submitting to something to a traditional publishing house. And many of them don't even seem to have not only a knowledge, but even a willpower to do this. They still just think they're going to write a book, you know, send it over and everything's fine, and they're going to sit back in the basement and cash checks. And I keep reminding people that that's not only not the case now, that's never going to be the case. It's the future means you're more involved, whether you like it or not.
Absolutely. I mean, you own, and this is one of those things that people don't necessarily think of or get. When you are an author, let's say you're a novelist, but I mean, this is going to be true whether you are a novelist, whether you are a copywriter, whether you are a journalist. Unless you are actually writing as an employee for someone else, you have a small business. You own a small business. And even if you're writing for a big five publisher, you own a small business. And so you have to think in all of those terms. Well, part of having any small business for success is going to be marketing. It's going to be branding, because we're no longer in an age where you sign with a publisher and you're with them for 30 years. It happens. It's just not like it used to be. And we're well past the days of the big advances, unless you are one of a very small handful of authors. You know, if you are, you know, if you're Scalzi, if you are Joe Hill, if you are, you know, Stephen King, if you, you know, if you're in one of this handful of people who, you know, J.K. Rowling, if you're one of these handful of people that has a built-in massive market, then sure, you can walk in and demand an advance. Other than that, the publishing industry is very much about what have you done for me lately? How well did your last book sell? And let's keep going. I mean, even if you sign a 3-book deal, if your first book doesn't go, you're not going to see book 2 and 3. So, as an author, marketing is your responsibility. Even if you're with one of the major publishers, marketing is your responsibility. So you just have to look at it that way. We're no longer in the days where, you know, you sign the deal with a publisher, they write you a big check, and then you go back to your apartment and you go back in New York and you sit there and you go start working on the next book and watch the royalty checks come in. That we're just well past those days. There's too much out there, too much new stuff coming. You have to stay engaged with readers, with fans, and it takes time to build that up. And if you let it drop off, you've got to do a lot of that work again to get them reengaged.
It's pretty much what I've been telling folks now for a while, because I've been discovering that not only myself personally, but, you know, just for doing research and talking to the other folks. I had mentioned on one of the shows that I had I submitted a nonfiction philosophical manuscript to a publisher over in England, and they wanted to know what my marketing plan was. When I gave it to them, they accepted it, but the terms are so horrible. I'm like, I'm going to have to do all this work anyway. Why would I want to work with the little money you're going to provide? I could just do this myself and do better, which is exactly what I had to do, and that's exactly what happened. So even after all that you've been asked to do, you still have to make a choice about whether it's going to be worth your while or not. I mean, you're doing 100% of the marketing work, and they're giving you 7% of royalties. That's just not much of a deal anymore. It's just sort of real ludicrous. And that was standard for, I would say, a mid indie publisher.
Well, and I mean, what you find with the royalty rates, you know, and I'm used to seeing somewhere in that 15% range. But then when you're dealing with, if you're dealing with an agent and whatnot, you know, you've got the agency cuts, but it doesn't really matter. You have to look at every book as an individual project and a product. And when you're trying to decide, am I going to try to shop this to a publisher? The first question you have to ask yourself is, what are your goals? What is it you want to do? Are you publishing this book and do you want to see it published because it is an ego thing? Are you doing this because it's part of how you make a living? Is this because you're trying to break into a particular market, a particular niche? You know, there's a lot of reasons why people write and publish books. Not all of them are about making money. I do some work with clients who are consultants, speakers, you know, stuff in that space. And we've seen the book as a business card diminish over the last couple of years, not because it's not effective, but because there's been so much crap dumped out there. And that's true in the self-publishing space as well. You know, that's true fiction, nonfiction, everything else. If I want to go and be published by a large major publisher, it's an ego boost. Yeah, I may not make as much of the money on the front end of that, but by saying I was published by Publishing House X, that also is then going to bring up the value of everything else I then publish later on. And if I've got something that gets picked up by even a mid-sized publisher every so often, the blend of how fast I can crank out the indie stuff and what I can put out there that's a little more unique versus the boost size of I'm still an author that is good enough to be picked up by these publishers is really where that success model lies these days, or seems to. And I mean, I expect it's going to keep shifting, but we haven't talked about it yet. But I mean, traditional publishing is very much in trouble. And it's not just traditional publishing. It's also bookstores that are very much in trouble. Their business model is very late 1800s centric.
Yeah, no doubt.
I mean, if I'm a publisher, and this is what affects us as writers, and that's the reason I'm going down this path. If I, as an author, get picked up by a traditional publisher, they go through, they're of course going to handle the covers. They're going to pay for the editing. They're going to pay for and do everything in the production of that book, and then start trying to market it and get space in bookstores. You have to remember, when you get into a traditional bookstore, that bookstore didn't buy that. That's not sitting in their inventory. It's on consignment. Same thing is true of magazines and periodicals. I've written a bunch of those over the years as well. So when something comes in and lands in, let's say, Barnes & Noble, and they buy 10,000 copies of it, it's on consignment. Well, then if 9,000 of those don't sell in 90 days, and it's a very short turnaround time, if you've got 9,000 books sitting there, you kind of have two choices. Have them returned to you at your cost, or you tell them to rip the cover off and destroy the rest. So you see large volumes of books that are printed and produced that are destroyed. They never sell. They never go to market. And so that means the publisher is absorbing that cost. The bookstore is absorbing some cost there as well. And the margins on books is already very tight to start with. So we see this as an industry, and then you see somebody come in like Amazon. You know, Amazon did not come out. You know, Kindle was not the first e-reader. I had a filament book reader. It was late 90s, mid-late 90s, somewhere in there. They never caught on because they never could get enough work published through there, and they were still trying to go the traditional model and the reader and everything else. But with Amazon starting as an online bookstore, and what they did with ebooks and everything else they've done, they've changed the industry radically. And not every way of it has been good, because the other thing I'll argue that Amazon has done to the industry and done to the writer, they've devalued our work. So if you look, they've created that idea of a book's only worth 99 cents or a book's only worth $2.99. If you're an indie author, they pretty much want you to sell your book somewhere between $2.99 and $9.99 as an ebook. That's just the niche. That's the space they want it in. And their pricing model and their quote unquote royalty model is set and structured to get you to do that. But they also want you selling a fair amount of stuff at 99 cents. While you don't make any money, they don't make any money. It does generate traffic and it generates flow through. And that's a lot of what props up if you look at things like Kindle Unlimited. So they've built a model where they are dumping tremendous volumes, and they're acting as a great portal for the writer, but at the same time, they're dumping tremendous volumes of stuff on the market as well. So you've got to do the work to get above that noise.
It's one of the biggest hurdles that a lot of writers seem to face. They don't really have a true understanding of what's going on. I mean, I think Barnes & Noble probably has 2-3 years left, and it's going to be gone, which is another place for an actual, you know, paperback books to be sold will be out of there. And we lost a few as it is. I mean, there's very few that's going to be left.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you look, there's only a few chain bookstores that are really even sort of holding on. The good news is we see a resurgence in the indie bookstores. And I love going to independent bookstores, both to do events, signings and stuff like that. But I also love to just go into them to sit, to read, to sort of soak up the space. I mean, it's one of those things that it's a lot of fun. And you find the indie bookstores create that experience when you come in. So if you are an avid reader, you're walking into an experience. And I think that's one of the big things that the indie bookstores give us, is that experience as both a reader and as an author. For example, we've got a couple of big ones here in Charlotte. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. Park Road Books does a lot for indie authors. And that is not a paid sponsorship, but, you know, Park Road Books does a lot for indie authors, both in the bookstore and for, you know, in the region. They do a lot of external events and whatnot with authors. So when you look at that, you see the indie bookstores. There's several others around the Charlotte area that I've gone to and worked with. There's others I've done events with all over the region. I do a lot of events all over the place. So, you know, when we can, we'll line up something in an indie bookstore, come in, do a signing. One of the fun side projects we have is something called Books and Beer, where and it's on Facebook. We're expanding the channel and stuff around it now. But what we do is we'll find somewhere, like, we'll go to the pub, have a few pints, and then do a reading. So instead of doing it at the bookstore, doing it at a convention where it's kind of that staid, quiet, reserved sort of environment, we go somewhere that's more fun. It lightens up and it brings in new readers, new fans, and people that aren't even necessarily strong readers get to hear the author telling their own story.
Oh, I love it. I think we should be coming up with new venues, and that's a great idea. Not to mention, why not get your book in the hands of somebody who is under the influence of alcohol? Sounds like a great sale to me.
Well, for example, a good friend of mine, John Hartness, you probably want to have a couple of drinks before you get too far into Bubba the Monster Hunter. especially when he tells the Sasquatch Dong story.
Wow.
That is also available online on Facebook. We haven't been banned for it yet, and it's almost clean. we have to find new and creative ways of getting books out there. In a couple of weeks, we've got a Scottish Games here in Charlotte called Lochnorman Highland Games. I'm one of the athletic directors for it. I run part of the kids event area. One of the things that we do with that is we have some of the local authors come in, John being one of them. Josh Robertson is coming in this year for the first time. And we have them come in, and they can tell the stories. They can do some readings. They can sell some books. They entertain and bring people in. You know, they bring in their fan base with them, of course, because, you know, some of these people, when you have an event, they're going to bring their fans with them. That's what you want. But the other thing it does is it gives them exposure to new potential fans, and it lets people meet the author. It lets them do some readings. It lets them tell their story. And doing it that way, it's not your traditional book event. It's not your traditional, you know, I'm coming in to do a reading or this or that or the other. But it's a creative way to let people get in. For example, I met Diana Gabaldon at a Scottish Games in 1997, 98, somewhere in there, when the first one of the Outlander books was out. And she was sitting at the Games under a little table, little booth. I was out there working in San Diego at the time, flying back and forth, and I decided to stay over the weekend and go see some friends that would be at the Games. We went out there. I met her, brought some of those back for friends of mine on the East Coast, you know, and got to meet and chat with her a while when she was still just sort of starting out as the author of Outlander. You never know what it's going to take that brings and builds your fan base. Well, we've got a large part of, you know, one of her fan groups coming out for Games in a couple of weeks, Grandfather Mountain Highland Games, where I'm on the athletics up there. We've had her come up and do signings up there as well. We've had them come out and, you know, had some of the fan groups come out, you know, from the Outlander fan group. So you never know what's going to happen. We've done the same thing with, you know, some of the Harry Potter stuff out at the same field. We've done the Quidditch tournaments and whatnot. When we do those, we can bring some authors out that write in the fantasy space. You have to find new and different ways to expose yourself to fans, and that means expose your books and your work, not anyway. But if you're out there and in that space, you have to find new ways to connect with fans and readers, and be who you are. And one of the challenges is that most authors are introverted. They're shy, they're quiet, and that's just the way they are. And so you have to find those things that allow you as an individual to then go out and meet and interact with fans. Social media has been fantastic for that, but it just as easily as it's a great place to go out and meet and interact with people in a relatively safe way, there's also just as many trolls that like to stir up trouble. You know, that for example, I've got friends who very recently, one of whom has had her poetry site blocked on Facebook because it was considered offensive. Well, the truth of it probably is that somebody was throwing a fit and they reported it as offensive. So then you have to go run through the paperwork to say, I write horror poetry, much of which has been published on Facebook. So just as much as it's a way to meet and connect with people on social media, bless you. Just as much as social is a way to meet and interact with people, it's also just as much a way for people that want to be destructive and hateful to come out and cause trouble because they're doing it for their own entertainment. Mm. That's also part of being an author and being out in public, is learning to put on a thick skin and deal with those people. You know, as a general rule, I strongly recommend that people be nice, respectful, but swing a band hammer. If somebody's on your page, somebody's in your group, in your friend group, whatever else, if somebody's disrespectful, rude, whatever else, swing that hammer and get them out of there. Don't tolerate anything because you don't want something that will infect your community or affect your fans, your readers.
Well, yeah, I definitely agree on that because I've seen this sort of thing happen before, and sometimes it just becomes another excuse for writers to not really be out there. But there's a lot of them are just not prepared for this, or like you say, they're a bit introverted. But I reminded them that, listen, this is knowing the present, but it's the future. If you're not figuring this out, if you're not out there, it's very difficult for you to really do anything with your work other than it's published and it's just sitting in a garage somewhere.
Well, I mean, even I'm a contributor in a few different Facebook groups, and occasionally I'll just get fed up and stop. But you see people that go out and say, you know, how do I do X for free? How do I do X for free? Well, the first thing is free is a lie. There is no such thing as free. It's going to cost you something. It's either costing you time, it's costing you money, or it's costing you some other resource. There is no such thing as free. And sometimes, yes, you can use social to generate buzz and bring people in so that it's not costing you investment in paid advertising. But all the social is now going to where it's paid anyway. So if you as an author, you as a creator, want to go out there and bring in fans that you can interact with, you know, again, we're back to the days where it's no longer free. And part of that cost is definitively dealing with the trolls. And one of the things that I've got in the book that goes back to an article I wrote years ago, and I republish about once a year. I've been known to republish it on April 1st before, and I forgot to do that this year, but is don't feed the trolls. And I go through a bunch of stuff, but fundamentally the lesson is don't feed the trolls. If somebody comes in and they're being difficult, they're being a challenge, they're being offensive, and they're doing something in your community, it is your job and your responsibility to swing that band hammer and take them out. How you do that, I think really depends on your personality. I try to be professional, respectful until I'm not. A friend of mine, Robert Bevan, I will tell you, I think some people just go and try to bait him for, play troll and bait him just to see how the response is going to come. He writes lit RPG stuff. He doesn't take himself seriously, and he just wants to go have fun. He makes a good living at it. He's a good Midlist author, and he's a lot of fun. But he also doesn't tolerate people being disrespectful other than him. But I mean, you know, he's not going to put up with a lot of BS.
I don't think anyone really should anyway. I remind people all the time when this sort of stuff happens, it's not something you can reason people with because you're such a wonderful writer. Sometimes all you have to do is block and move on. There's nothing really more you can do because oftentimes all you're doing is encouraging people just to be more idiotic the next day.
Yeah, and it's a no-win situation. So if you're fighting that game, just ban them and go on.
That's all you can really do. I don't really see any other thing. I don't really think anyone's going to get on there, act bigoted and disrespectful, and then after you say something to them, they're going to say, you know, upon reflection, I'm really not doing a good – no one's doing that. Just get rid of them and move on. They're just there to play around. They're not there to be serious anyway.
No, I mean it – I will tell you, one of the things you find a lot of the time amongst trolls is one of two things. We've seen a lot of this on social as of late with people that write in certain genres. If you're writing in the LGBTQ space, if you're writing in even some of the romance space, if you're writing in some of the horror space, there are a lot of groups that actively like to go out and cause trouble for those authors, have them banned on Facebook, have them banned in different places because they don't like it. It offends their own personal ethos. And instead of having that ability to say somebody's different from me, I may or may not, I may not agree with what they're doing, but you know, keep going on. Instead, they actively go try to cause trouble. The other thing we see is people who are authors that think that by tearing someone else down, they lift themselves up. That is a very short-sighted and short-term space. Is if you go and if you're causing trouble for other authors, word spreads. You know, publishers talk, small publishers talk, medium publishers talk, authors talk. You know, for example, at Dragon Con, I've been going to Dragon Con for years and years and years, and I, you know, you sit in the bar with hundreds of writers, you know, hundreds of authors. If somebody in your space has been difficult to deal with, you're sitting in the space with authors, publishers, editors, agents, people talk. And your online persona and what you do online will determine your long-term future. And if you think in the short term, being disruptive, being destructive to somebody else's career is going to help you, it does not. You know, and I've seen it completely and totally implode some people who are very creative, very good writers, spend their time being destructive and negative, and their careers are over. You're just done because nobody else is going to do business with you. And eventually even your readers are going to figure that out.
Yeah, that's a sad predicament. It really is.
So, I mean, the number one thing, if nothing else, any writers out there that hear this, the most important thing that you can have as a writer, other than, you know, continuing to build skill, is build your network. Build your network of friends, because the other fun bit is this. You as a writer can never produce enough work for a good, solid reader. You just can't. You physically cannot write that much. So by having networks of people in a similar space, similar genre, that you can all work with and support each other, will make the difference in your career. Because not only do you make each other better writers and better authors from a support standpoint, you also then get to share fans and introduce people to each other. So build your network, be collaborative, work with other people, and it benefits you, it benefits them, it benefits your readers. I mean, that's the number one thing that I preach all the time. And especially if you're very shy, I'm obviously horribly shy, but if you're a very shy and introverted writer, having the right people that you're partnered with and work with that help give you some space and help build that career are going to be what help determine your level of success these days.
Well, it's definitely great advice. It's not part of something I've heard before, even though it makes a lot of sense to me, because I still believe that the writer having their future in their own hands, and if they're not doing something to build even a cursory network or a way to have a groundswell from what they're doing, and maybe that introduces them out to people so they can be less shy and be a little bit more you know, proactive. That's definitely a great plan. I just hope more writers are going to do that. I wrote and I produced a show called The Future of Writing, and I know probably sounds a bit arrogant, but it's simply my predictions of the future. And one of the things I had mentioned, I wasn't trying to be cold or cruel, but I had mentioned that, listen, that the future might literally bring that the writers that succeed are simply the writers that figured out how to market better or to market at all, which means that you might have writing in the future that may not have been as good as others, but they're out there because they're out there, and you're not, and it's not going to go anywhere then. It's just unfortunately that simple.
Well, I mean, we're already there. I mean, that is the market today. Unless you get very lucky, and I mean, I stamp that all over the place. Unless you get very lucky or have very specific kinds of connections or work in certain industries, if you just write a book and you put it out there and are waiting for the money to roll in, you're going to be hearing the crickets chirping. I was in a group contributing, and we had a conversation going not long ago, and somebody was going through and they said, you know, how do I do this for free? I don't have any money. And I said, well, and kind of going back to my conversation from earlier, nothing's free. It's a question of how do you want to invest in your career? How do you invest in your business? But if you are at a point where, and like many authors, because again, we're back to the industry doesn't pay like it used to, or you're a startup author, you're trying to front it. How much time do you want to spend and invest using social media and going out there and trying to build relationships and engage and push? You know, you're going to spend a lot of time because just the platforms are no longer geared towards the organic traffic like they used to be, unless you're doing something very unique that the platforms are going to reward you for. If you as an author are trying to build that career, you're trying to build that platform, you're in a space where those relationships that you can build are going to be the things that pull you forward faster and further than the ones that pull you behind and hold you behind. And that's the other hard part. I'm very fortunate. I'm a member of a couple of different writers groups here in Charlotte, as well as a couple of other places as well. I do a lot of stuff online. I'm continuously working on craft. I'm continuously working on business. I'm continuously working on a lot of different spaces, as well as what I try to do in working with different clients. So when I'm doing that, I get to see the viewpoint from a lot of different people at different spaces in the industry and see what works for some people, what doesn't work for others, and that experiment. Well, if you're in that position where you can't pay for it and you can't do it, you've got to expect that you're going to spend a lot of time out there trying to build relationships. And when I recommend this, you know, that doesn't mean I went onto Twitter and posted "buy my book 800 times today. That'll work for short bursts of time. Yes, you can post, "here's my book, buy my book, buy my book." But you also have to be putting other stuff in there that says, "here's who I am. Here's why I do what I do." You want people to build a virtual relationship with you. It's the old business adage. People do business with people they like, know, and trust, or that they believe can provide something to them that they can't get otherwise. If you're a fiction writer, you provide potentially an extraordinarily valuable service. And I think this is one of those things that we as fiction writers often forget. You're providing the reader an opportunity to explore a different world, a different story, a different viewpoint. But you're also offering them oftentimes an escape from the problems of their daily life. You're offering them a chance to explore their own issues, their own challenges, and help guide them in a way to get through and build themselves and their physical life. This is why we see fandoms build up the way that we do, is because people resonate with the story. They resonate with the characters. They resonate with that life. And so when you see things like cosplay and you see people dress up in character, that's an extraordinarily valuable service we're providing those fans, because they're building such a big part of their life and their identity in that. And often what that means is there was something that they, as a fan, they, as a reader, they found a way to help deal with personal issues, personal challenges, or they just simply found a joy in living that part of their life. If you look at something like the Star Wars fandom, you look at something again like Harry Potter fandom, there's a lot of very positive stuff that comes out of that for the reader and for the fan outside of the fact of once they finished your book. And if you're fortunate enough to ever have that level of impact on even just one fan, just one reader, you know, that's a valuable service you're providing. And you also then have a much greater responsibility to your readers to make sure that you're executing on that well.
Wow, that's certainly a wonderful way of putting that your writing can be basically escapist, and therefore you have a responsibility to give them the best escapist experience possible.
Exactly. Or, you know, even if it's not escapism. You know, I will tell you, for example, I read on average about 5 books a week. About 2 of those are fiction. A lot of the time, seeing how people deal with challenges in fiction, and I do the same thing in my writing. A lot of my writing, I mean, I'll tell you the story. Probably my best-selling story is a novella called Nobody's Business. I wrote it halfway as a joke because I just it was one of those things that struck me as funny. I had been to police school for writers, their first year in Wisconsin. If you're a writer at all in the crime space, crime genre, I can't recommend the WPA highly enough. And some of the friendships I made there in that space, I've still got. Well, I don't really write a lot in the mystery crime genre, but it's fun to play with. I mean, again, when you're writing in different genres, crime, mystery, fiction appears in a lot of spaces. Well, I was on the flight home and I said, okay, now I got to figure out how I'm going to turn this into a business expense. And so when I got home, flying from Wisconsin, and on my step is a box from ThinkGeek, and I open it up, and inside is a gnome statue that's about 16 inches tall, swinging a Tommy gun, and it says, "Say hello to my little friend." He's got this mad look on his face, and I said, "That's it. Somebody's killing gnomes and turning them into garden statues." And that book sells more than anything else. Now, a lot of the time people go pick up that book, and then they'll buy everything else in both that series and the spinoff series, the fourth book of which I'm working on again, and I'm working on another gnome book because they're just fun to play with. But at the same time, as a writer, I can explore very complex and sometimes disturbing topics because I can go out there and torture a gnome and people are going to go either say, "I hate gnomes, they're creepy, that's great," or they look at me and they go and they say, "I love gnomes, they're cute, how could you possibly do that?" Well, I can do these things to a mythological creature that if I was doing that to small children, that would be an entire different readership and an entire level of disturbing. So when I wrote that book, and again, it was a tremendous amount of fun to write. It was a tremendous amount of fun to play with. But again, as I wrote, as I did it, as I developed it, I was working on some other stuff personally. And the act of writing lets me process through and work on other things while I'm doing writing. It's my creative outlet that lets me not only express myself, but it also lets me work through different things for myself. And I think every writer that has any real materiality into it, when we write a story, there's a lot of us tied up in those characters.
God, I hope so.
And, well, occasionally I find stuff that winds up in a character. I'm like, ooh, I hope that's not actually coming out of me. I hope that's something else. But, you know, or the other thing, because I traveled for so many years, when you live in airports and hotels and all the rest of that, you get to see both the best and the worst of humanity. Sometimes you get driven to be both the best and the worst of humanity. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a backlog of characters I can use from now until about the year 4320. But with some of the work that I've done over the years and whatnot, if I have somebody that's being particularly problematic, or if I have a scenario I'm working with in my daily life and my career, a lot of the time that becomes a plot point, because it's a lot easier to kill somebody on paper than it is to actually have to get rid of the body. And so, you know, when you go through these creative exercises as a writer, you have to remember this is just as much about you as it is about your fans and your readers. And a lot of what you're going through and processing at any given time is going to show up in your work.
I definitely believe that's the case. And I think it also has a relationship to sometimes people's reaction to rejection. Oftentimes rejection doesn't feel, well, I just need to tinker with my product and everything will be okay. Sometimes rejection is like, wow, they don't like what I'm doing and part of me is in that thing. So it feels that much more hurtful.
Well, as a writer, the number one thing you're going to have to deal with is rejection. It's just part of the name of the business. And again, it goes back to you got to put on a thick skin. And there are times it still is painful, but it can be rejection by an agent, rejection by the publisher. Well, a lot of the time that rejection is not you. It's not the quality of your work. It's I've published, we've already bought two other stories that have, serial killing gnomes in them or, if you've got, you have to know it's still a business as a publisher, as an agent. If you are signing on a writer, your business is now tied to them as a product. So, and again, this goes back to your behavior online and your physical presence as a writer and a creative has a lot of influence on this too. But just the fact that an agent or a publisher didn't buy your work doesn't necessarily mean it's not good. It could mean it's just not a fit for them. It could mean you didn't follow the submission guidelines, and so they never even saw your work. They tossed it because you used the wrong font. You sent it in the wrong format.
Yeah, I preach this a great deal. I tell people there's a good percentage of rejection just because you simply disobeyed rules, even if you didn't realize you did. So you have to really review that like 3-4 times before you put it out there.
It's like the old story about, I think it's Van Halen. They used to – one of the things that was in their contract – was that they wanted a bowl of M&Ms and there couldn't be, I think it was any brown ones in there. So that wasn't there because somebody had a phobia about brown M&Ms. That was because that was a test. When they as a band would come in, if they saw the bowl of M&Ms sitting there, great. If there were brown ones in it, they knew somebody hadn't paid that much attention to the contract. And they knew that there might be other problems they need to look at deeper. So as a publisher, you'll find a lot of them will slip something odd in there to see if you're paying attention and to see how easily you are to take instruction and work with people. Because again, you as a writer, if you sign up with a publisher or with an agent, this is a business relationship between both of you. You can have the best book on the planet. If you are going to be difficult to work with, there are publishers even that would knowingly turn away a Harry Potter, a 50 Shades of Grey, just to not have to deal with the author. And the odds of you cranking out something that is that next major phenomenon is so very low that it's much easier to say if this is somebody who can't follow directions. Or when you send in that query letter, it's 8 pages about, about your dog and the dying flower that has no relevance whatsoever. Again, you're much more likely to get the boot before they ever see your manuscript, before they ever see your work. And then when you talk about rejection from readers, of course, that hurts a little bit harder. When you get that first 1-star review, there's that thing of, wait, somebody doesn't like me? How can they not like my baby? Well, you have to put on the thick skin. When I got my first 1-star review, I actually wrote a thank you post and posted it up because I'd gotten a fair number of 4- and 5-star reviews at that point, and I posted up a thank you note because their entire review was, I don't get it. And I posted up this whole thing about, I want to thank you for giving me the 1-star because now I feel like a real author in the genre. And number 2, you're not my reader, but thank you for giving it a try. And I wrote this whole thing that was just as much about me going and acknowledging not everybody's going to love me, not everybody's going to love my work. It was much easier to do that and publish it out there and say, thanks for giving it a try. You don't have to read the rest of them. Thanking somebody just for actually leaving the review, it's meaningful. You can't live and die by the good and negative reviews. And honestly, most of the time, there's nothing valuable there in a negative review. But occasionally there is. But you're going to get them. If you publish enough, look at any book out there. You can look at any book or any product out there. And if you don't see a negative review, that's when I get worried, because that means it's not real.
Yeah, that's what I say too.
Because inevitably there's going to be somebody that doesn't like, doesn't resonate with your work. And you just have to keep moving on. There's also that thing of if you're sitting in a booth, you're sitting in an event, you're selling books, and the people that walk by, you have to learn and get used to the fact that, you know, just because you've written a book does not mean it's going to resonate with 99% of the people that come and walk by your booth.
I think that's the part that writers, they just need to really learn to engage in. Maybe start a small event or something new that they've created themselves, but they have to be out there, and they have to start learning that, because I think not only is it a way for them to get a better idea of how to present themselves and their products, but also it might be a good way for them to start building that thick skin they're going to need going forward.
Absolutely. And I will tell you, your first event is going to suck. You're going to say, you know, especially if you're doing it there by yourself and you're sitting in the booth, you know, alone and by yourself. I did a little small library event this past weekend here in Charlotte. We had a lot of fun. I knew all the authors there but one, who was coming out with a book of poetry. Very, very nice. But all the rest of us know each other. We do a lot of traveling together. We do a lot of conventions together. We all know each other and are a little harsh to each other. And, you know, for somebody from the outside, they probably look and wonder about, you know, is it safe to be in the same room? And in truth, so, you know, a lot of us all room together. You know, we'll all pack into a hotel room, because if you're at a convention, you're, you know, at best you're getting your couple of hours of sleep. So you just need somewhere to stuff the extra inventory and throw your bag of clothes. And, you know, so when you do things like that together and you have that kind of relationship, if you are not used to seeing that as a new author coming in trying to do your first event, which he was, finding that first small event is critical, because it's going to be a little painful. It's going to feel a little uncomfortable. And if you've got somebody that can come with you and sit there with you just to hang out, feel a moral support. If you can have a couple of friends just come through to stop at the booth and say hi, all of that helps kind of boost you up. And it takes time to build those relationships, and it takes time to build your pitch. It takes time to figure out what's wrong with your book and your product. Even if it came out from a trade publisher, there's stuff about it that you need to understand and know how to sell it better. Because again, once you get to that stage that you're sitting in front of a customer, whether that's online, whether that's at a library event, whether that's sitting in a room with 1,000 people, doesn't matter. You still have to know and make that shift between, this is my baby. I birthed it. It's out. The words are on the paper. Here it is. It's perfect. And it's not. But, you know, you're telling yourself, this is the best thing since Betty White and sliced bread. And then the first fans go look and go and say, not for me. That's not an indictment of you. That's not an indictment of the work. That's not rejecting you. That's looking and saying, that's not for me. Because you have to remember, we as writers also all have a bit of that narcissism going on, that, you know, we've poured, we've bled, we've done what it takes to build that piece of work. And then we look and say, well, but why doesn't every single human being on the planet like it? The answer is because not every single human being on the planet can agree to anything. I mean, if you know, not every single human being on the planet is going to agree to sugar. So they're not all going to agree to your work either. And it's just a matter of knowing and learning to find and identify your tribe. And what I mean by your tribe, that is both your fans as well as the people that will help build you and support your career.
Well, it's definitely some of the best advice that can be given. I've noticed, and I've called out some writers, not publicly because I'm not trying to hurt anybody, but privately, to remind them that yes, they have to view the book as a product. And some of them have resistance just to the terminology. Well, Mark, it's a book I worked on for a year. Okay, yeah, it's a book you worked on for a year. Now that you're in the selling stage, it's a product. You need to learn about how you're going to be able to convey that to people who might be your reader. If you don't look at it that way, yeah, I labored in a room for a year. It's not much of a selling point, and it's no longer than just a product. It's almost like you still got it back there in the basement somewhere, and that's just not going to work.
No, I mean, and the other thing you have to remember is, to you, it may not be a product. To everyone else around you, including your agent, including your publisher, including Amazon, it's a product, one amongst millions being produced every year. And so you have to remember that a little bit yourself so that you can take the right actions. You can market it right. You can sell it right. And, you know, yes, it feels a little bit odd to say, I've got to go out and sell my baby that I spent all this time and poured it into. But yeah, it's a product. I mean, it's a widget. And if you can learn to put on that different persona, the part of you that's the salesman, the salesperson, the one that goes out and is selling the product, that just knows what it is, knows it intimately, but can detach from it enough to know who is a good fit, that will help you invaluably. I mean, I will tell you, everybody I know that goes up on stage, and I've spent a fair amount of time talking in front of people. If you walk up on stage, and I don't care if the room has two people in it, it has 20 people in it, it has 2,000 people in it, you're walking out in front of people, and even if they're hardcore fans, at some point you're going to put something out they don't necessarily like or love. And that's just true. If you put out enough work, period, there's going to be something that people go and say, eh, okay, well, it was just another X. I mean, look at Star Wars. You know, look at George Lucas with what he did with 1, 2, and 3. They were bad movies, but and I say that having grown up on the originals, but even if you have the most ardent following, there's always going to be people that look and say, this could have been better, that could have been better. And there's probably truth in that. And learning to take that feedback, again, is invaluable. And learning that that feedback is going to come helps you put on the right persona. It helps you put on the right armor when you're walking to be in front of those people so that you can take constructive criticism. You can take feedback and incorporate what makes sense to you and shed the rest and go on with your day. You can't sit and wallow in one bad review. You can't sit and you know, mull over the fact that somebody didn't like something you did. Guess what? The majority of people are not going to resonate with what you do. And that's fine. I don't want the majority of people. I want the people that resonate with what I do and with the work that I'm doing. And that's my target. And I've learned that over the years. One of the things that you'll see me pop up when the majority of the time, if I'm doing an event, you're going to find me there in a kilt and usually an obnoxious t-shirt. And occasionally you'll find a Hawaiian shirt thrown over the top of it. I spend a lot of time in a kilt because I do a lot of Scottish athletics and other stuff. I'm comfortable in one. I'm happy in one. And it's part of my brand. It's part of my marketing. But there's also this thing of, I know when I've put that on, it helps me shift my personality a little bit to know that that's the persona that I'm in. It's still me. It's just me cranked up to probably 11. Not necessarily saying that's always a good thing, but that's what it is.
Wow. I notice these things are coming out a lot more, these Scottish events. I went to one for the first time last year with my son. He wanted to check it out and outside of Jacksonville. So we had a lot of fun. Of course, watching lots of people walking around with skirts, that was definitely unusual. My son thought, are we in the right event? I'm like, yes, relax. This is something cultural, okay? And we learned a lot. It was a lot of fun. A lot of stuff about Outlander, too. I kind of expected that. But it was a great time. And we're Italian, but it was nice to see something different. And I really liked it. I did notice that there were some people selling books out there as well, too. So I kind of kept my eyes Yeah, I see how these things could really work, and people really need to start latching more onto that. I think for my audience on the show, there's part literary, and then there's part that are commercial. And I think that there's different feelings about how to sell things, or if they should sell things in this manner. The literary people are sometimes a little bit more stringent about how they want to do things. And I reminded them, hey, if you're just looking for minimal sales, you want to put a couple projects out and feel you accomplished something artistically, you have, and that's fine. But if you want to go another level, well, there's 20 other things you need to be doing that they probably should have did a year before you put the book out.
Yeah, and I mean, I've done a little bit of literary, mostly in short stories. It's still one of those things that it doesn't really matter what you're writing. It depends on what your goals are. And this, as a writer, again, is one of those things that's a bit of a challenge. We see as writers a lot of really great goal-based tools around productivity. I mean, if you look at something like NaNoWriMo and the sprints, and if you look at all the stuff that's done around productivity as an author, getting it generated, getting it done, getting it out the door, creating the work. Well, then what happens is the rest of the business falls on the floor. And so when you look at that, it's a very painful thing because at the end of the day, if you've poured your heart and soul into something and your goal was to pour your heart and soul into a piece of work that 20 people are going to read and those 20 people can get it, you've accomplished your goal. If the 21st person picks it up, reads it, and loves it, that's your bonus. I mean, I occasionally get stuff in where people are working on memoirs. They're working on something, a book of poetry. They're working on these things that they're not necessarily doing because they want massive sales. They're doing them because it's an expression of who they are, and they want to publish it because it's that feeling of accomplishment that it actually got out there. And the act of publishing a book, even if it's self-published, is one of those things that allows you to say, no, this is real, and it's out in the open, it's out the door. That's a huge accomplishment in and of itself, just to get the words done and get something out and published. But that's not necessarily going to be something that's commercial. That's not
Right.
necessarily something that's going to be there to help you make a living. If your goal and your intention is to make money and turn a profit from the work that you're doing, and there is no sin in making money from creative work. This is one of those things I preach about frequently. There is nothing wrong. There is no sin in making money from creative work. If that's what you're looking at and you're faced with, and a lot of people have that money problem and that money issue, the reason that they hold themselves back and the reason that they don't publicize, the reason they don't push the work, is they have that fear that A, I don't want to make money from it because making money is wrong. And B, if they're successful, what will all these other people think of them? And this goes back to that fear thing we were talking about a while ago about getting past yourself to get the work out the door.
Well, I
Well, if
definitely,
your work.
I'm definitely happy to recommend your book, A Business Essential for Writers, and I think mainly because I've spoken to a number of art professors and writing professors and even writing instructors, and what they've told me is that oftentimes the institution is not really prepared to teach folks about that next steps of marketing. They'll teach them all how to be creative and even how to put together a book, but not anything beyond that.
No, I mean it's very true. I mean, and the reason I wrote this book, I'll tell that story, is I wrote the book because I had enough friends coming to me going and looking at me and going saying, "You're one of those weird business techie kind of people, right?" And the answer is sure. Well, I'll tell you also in the business and technology world, I get that look that says, "You're one of those weird sort of creative people, right?" And I'll look at you,
Oh
yes.
boy.
So I don't fit in either world entirely. But I started, they would ask me a question and I would say, okay, well here, and I go blah, and we'd lay it out and they'd look at me and go, that all sounded really important and I have no idea what you just said. Can you explain it to me? And then, so what I started doing was, because I was working on and writing for a number of different sites and a couple of of periodicals and whatnot, I would write an article using that question as an inspiration. I'd write the article, we'd post it out. Some of those things are on Quora, some, you know. Well, we'd start posting those up and put that out, and I'd say, because if I got to answer it for one person, I may as well answer it for anybody who has that question, right?
Yeah.
Well, then that became a site we founded, which was called The Writer's Mind. And The Writer Mind, you know, was where I just started posting a bunch of that stuff up. And then in collaboration with a couple of friends of mine and with Falstaff Books, we actually took it and converted it over and formed a company called Author Essentials. And like I say, this is the first book we've got for Author Essentials. But we're doing publications, we're doing video workshops, we're doing some live workshops, and all of it's about the business side of being an author, you know, the tools of being an author. It's all the other stuff that nobody's answering. And the reason I started it was because I had people asking me questions, and that's a lot of the work that's in this book is refined and culled down from collections and collections of articles done over a number of years. And there's a lot of other new and original content in there as well. But, you know, that's where this book got its start, was because I had people coming and asking me those questions. So that's really where this came from.
Well, it makes sense to me. It really does, because I think it's a needed thing. And you find out that organizations and institutions and even workshops are not really addressing the whole marketing end of things, which now become more critical than ever before. That really puts writers, especially if they want to go in a commercial realm or if they want to go to that next step, where do they go through? I mean, getting, you know, piecemeal information on social media, that's not really a business plan or a marketing plan.
No, and right now I'm working on, originally this book was written to be basically a business plan for authors. And there's a template that's going to be available for free on the site. hopefully in the next month or so, it's in editing right now. That is a business plan template, but I shifted back from that because it was actually further down the road than most people were ready for, based on the book and the feedback and the beta reads and everything we went through.
Gotcha.
But the template and all is going to be available for that. But I mean, really what's important is knowing what is it you need to know. And that's what this book is designed to be, is a fundamentals book. And when I say that, it really and truly is designed to be a fundamentals book, where it's also going to be a set of workshops. I've taught small versions of the workshops. We're working on recording the workshops now, so that depending on what medium you prefer, we're also recording the audiobook right now. But depending on what medium you want and how you want to go through and progress with it, we're going to have it in a number of different formats. The workshops that will be available online and the ones that I teach also dive a little bit deeper into some of the topics. We've got upcoming, it's going to be one about the reader avatar, in other words, how to build your customer avatar, and then how to use that reader avatar in not only your sales and marketing, but also how to use it when you are trying to connect to your readers. How do you use knowing your reader in a way to help improve your writing so that you're speaking to who your audience is better? We have right now a video workshop up on called Path to Publication. This is John Hartness's workshop. He's owner and founder for Falstaff Books. He writes for Bellbridge and some others as well. And it's a course he's taught for a number of years. We recorded it. We've cut it into a set of workshops. And it's everything from how to do indie publishing up to how to do Big Five, how to work with an agent, how does money work, all these sorts of things. So that was the first workshop we put out. We've got some coming out right now that'll be about Evernote. We're in the process of editing that right now. We've got some other workshops in the process of licensing. Some of these are going to be free. Not all of them, of course, can be, because, hey, we're still a business and we've got to get money going through the door.
I hear you. I think it's really essential what you're doing over there. So, not to ape your book title over there, but it really is, because it's better for people to have something that's more formal and easy accessible for them to look at. I mean, nobody's going to have all the answers out there, including yourself, but this is a very good start for folks. I've been reminding people of not just trying to do things that are unusual or just creative to get the books out there, but even the podcast. I mean, I'm already taking in orders for people to advertise their books. I mean, a lot of podcasts won't do that. Well, that's not interesting, even if they're an artistic podcast. I don't like that idea. Tell them to come on and talk about the book. I mean, maybe they're too shy. Maybe they're not interested in doing it that way. Maybe it's just want to pay a small fee to have an ad run on a show for a month like ours. So it's another avenue for people to do something in an inexpensive way, but in a way to expose them to an audience that just might want to grab onto their book. So I'm happy to do that, and I'm happy to see that more and more people are going to start getting more interested in that, because I think pushing this marketing end of publishing is really essential, because I hate to see people fall down after all the work they've done because of this other part that either they can't get a hold of, or they don't want to get a hold of, or they just don't feel confident enough. Well, there's things out there more and more now that folks can do, including your book. That's Business Essential for Writers, folks, by James Nettles. James, thank you very much for being on to the show over here. A lot of important information, a lot that we don't really hear from the inside, and especially from a person that's actually done this themselves. So I'm really happy to have it from firsthand. It makes it a really valuable episode that I suspect that people are going to listen to again and again.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. We've been having some fun chats behind the scenes and all, and I think you've been putting some good episodes out with the show. So definitely appreciate you having me on.
Oh, yeah. I feel it's important to try to cover as many aspects of writing and creativity and more now about marketing than can be done, because there's not a lot of shows that are doing this at all. I mean, I did a show the other day about sexual harassment. Believe it or not, in creativity, from editors or from other people, even from social media, because I've had people in the background asking me, can you talk about this? Because nobody else wanted to talk about it, and it was such a big hit and such a catharsis for other folks, and it also helped some women out there to make sure that they step forward and you know, and push that junk away so they can get, you know, what they need to get done. So these things need to be talked about, and I'm very happy that they've created a forum to do so.
Well, and I'll tell you, that alone is a huge issue, especially especially on the convention circuit. There is a huge issue on the circuit, and that's among sometimes it's writers, sometimes it's promoters, and sometimes it's fans. And I mean, it's a huge issue out there, and it's one of those things that we don't talk about. We bury ourselves behind it. So I'm glad you did that episode.
Yeah, I am too, because I had a few people ask me, and then I mentioned to them, I wasn't trying to be impolite, but I'm like, why haven't you said anything? And you know, most of the times the answer was, well, I don't really have a forum to say that in. I'm like, well, maybe I need to make this then that, and it's not just, cause I'm not trying to be a jerk, but at the same point, you're always wondering as a guy, how do you let somebody do this for a year to you, and then you don't say anything? Now I'm starting to understand why. So I'm going to try to be part of the solution to that rather than being part of the problem. Not that I do things like that, but, you know, if I'm not saying anything, in a way, I'm kind of a part of the problem too, because it really is reprehensible. And, you know, as a guy, I mean, jeez, I can't believe people act this way. So I'm hoping we can make a dent in that sort of nonsense.
Yeah, last year at Dragon Con, I'm on EFF a lot, the Electronic Frontiers track a lot. 2 years ago, my wife and I did a panel called The Future of Sex Tech. So we were going through and walking through augmented reality, VR, and a lot of stuff that was happening. Last year, they asked us to come in and talk about love, sex, and dating in the post-Me Too era. She works a lot with entrepreneurs and executives, and a lot of what she deals with is fundamentally God, sex, and money, the golden trio. Mm. And we had a room, packed room on Saturday night with the party going on outside, coming in to talk about this. Well, we also brought another friend of mine on who is of color and who is gender fluid and has some other stuff in the background, so that it just wasn't an old straight white couple sitting up on the panel talking about Me Too, because – I'd be the one standing there with the target on my chest, you know, a late 40s, you know, white male standing there in a kilt. But, you know, standing there, I am the point of that aggression. And we went back and forth a lot about whether or not to do that panel. And because, I mean, it was one of those things that, we knew would bring us some heat and take us some shots. And we ultimately decided it was better. It was more beneficial to have the conversation and raise the conversation than it was for the personal heat we might take for that. So, you know, we did that last year. We're working on our programming for this coming year for that track. So that should be interesting. But no, I mean, I'm glad you took on that topic, because it's one that very rarely gets tackled. And usually the way it does get tackled is very aggressive, and it comes out of a point of frustration. And I think we're all frustrated with the harassment and a lot of the things that have gone on. If you look at Gamergate, and some of the things that went on with that, it's definitively a challenge. And a lot of it comes out of people that are afraid themselves, and they act out against others because that's what makes them feel better. And I will tell you that doesn't fly very well for me.
It definitely doesn't for me. I'm still raising two young boys over here, and I want them to have the right manners as they act, you know, as they become teenagers and become around girls. And I definitely don't want them to be using any of this sort of nonsense. It's just no good reason for that. It really isn't. It's not hard to have a conversation with a girl, and it's certainly not difficult to, you know, to do things in a polite and gentlemanly manner in order to get a date and go from there. All of this other nonsense has to be some sort of perverted insecurity or something, because I don't understand why it's necessary then. It's not just a bunch of shy guys acting weird. There's something else deeper going on, but it's just not acceptable. I mean, we had editors literally telling girls, well, if you don't give me some pictures of you half naked, I'm not going to publish you. I mean, this sort of nonsense is ridiculous. I even contacted them. I said, you better not come near any of my people. That's just not going to work out for me at all.
No.
I go,
I mean, it's...
I don't even know if it's legal, but it's just definitely unethical.
The legality of it, in most places, it's mostly legal, but it's sure as hell unethical.
And certainly unnecessary anyway. And I was telling some of the ladies I know. I mean, I'm sorry that... That publication might not be the best place for you until they change the editor one day. I mean, you're just going to have to go somewhere else. There's just no other way around it. They're not going to stop this behavior, or suddenly it's going to clink on their head. You know, I really shouldn't exchange nudie photographs for a publication. I mean, it's...
Well, the other thing, too, is you need to not be afraid to come out and say when those things happen. Because if they've happened to you, they've happened to other people. And not only has it happened to other people, they were quiet about it too.
Yeah. And it's the silence that kind of pees me off about the whole thing. And I try not to be too rough about it, but some have simply told me that, listen, I don't come out because I don't know what kind of reception I'm going to get from guys that don't do this. I don't know if they're just going to laugh it off or put it under the rug or accuse me. And then she goes, it's another insult on top of the injury already. So I can imagine how, you know, somebody would want to withhold that for a while, even though I'm still convinced that the moment this sort of stuff happens, it needs to be out there. You can't tell me about it 3 and 4 years later.
Right. And, well, I mean, I think people are feeling more secure now about being open about all sorts of assaults, physical, verbal, emotional. It becomes a challenge, and you get buried underneath it, and you have to be – it again becomes almost like another attack when you have to verbalize that. You want to come out about it. When you do that, you're bringing it all up again and then opening yourself up, because we societally are geared towards, you know, looking and saying, well, you had to have at least been partially at fault. And largely that's not going to be true. But staying silent about it is. And again, we don't, you know, people don't want to be embarrassed. People don't want to necessarily call out and embarrass other people. But again, at the end of the day, you have to be ready to come in and at least have a conversation about it.
And I'm trying to encourage that more and more. And I've been telling the ladies, especially, that this was happening to. I said, listen, I'm going to draw a line here. I think it's fair. I don't believe that there's anything you've done to encourage this, but I do believe that you let it go too long. In a way, you're giving this guy an additional piece of power, an additional license to do this to 10 and 20 other people. And in that part, you do bear some small responsibility for it.
Yes, and I mean that's the hard part for a lot of people is to remember you may not have incited it, but you have a responsibility when things happen. Sometimes it just needs to be a conversation between the two of you to say this is not appropriate, and it's over and done. Other things, if it's so far over the top, then yeah, you need to out that and need to make sure it's public. And I will tell you, and again, when you get into some of the convention circuit, while it's definitively the minority of the time and the exception to the rule, we see a lot of strange things happen behind the scenes. And that's not just in the writer space. When I've done technology conventions, when I've done business conventions, when I've done trade conventions, there's always an undercurrent of things that are going on there that are A, not good for the event, the convention, and it's not good for the people that are the participants that are there to be the experts that are speaking on stage. That's not good for the attendees. There's a whole lot of stuff that just goes on. And nobody wants to talk about it. They just want to, blow it over and keep going. Sometimes, yeah, it's not worth the blowback you might get, but a lot of the time what we see is egregious and needs to be dealt with and addressed, because not only is it going to have happened to you, it's also going to have happened to other people. And if it's not addressed, it's going to continue to happen. And so the question is who's going to be the one that finally steps up and deals with it? And unfortunately, a lot of the time when somebody who does finally step up to deal with it, belief is still a factor. Credibility is still a factor. All those sorts of things happen depending on who it is you're taking on.
No doubt. It was a well-received episode, but it was also the only episode of the 30 I've put out so far that I've gotten some negative feedback on as well. Folks, including women, saying maybe this was better off in some other show, not really a show about literary. And I keep telling folks, listen, if we're all saying here and we're believing that a woman's role in the literature is just as important as a man's, and that they often have viewpoints and they often have voices that I'm never going to have, then if we allow this nonsense to continue, you push some of that out of literary world, then in many ways you're hurting not only just women, but you're hurting literature. So that's been my viewpoint, that it hurts literature as much as it hurts women, and it shouldn't be allowed.
Agreed. Well, and it's not just women. I mean, it goes both ways.
I haven't had any men or gay people tell me about this yet. I mean, I believe that probably happens there too, but it was only the women that brought it up. So that's the only reason why I did that show, women based, because that was the only ones that came up to me and told me anything.
Well, and I mean, we see and we hear that a lot, but I can tell you definitively, it is not just women that encounter and go through it.
I definitely believe that, and God knows if I hear something like that more, and I'd be happy to have a show about that, but it really is the same principles of speaking up and trying to make sure that we isolate these individuals and stop this kind of nonsense, because this is simply no good place for it in the world, and certainly no place for it in writing. It's such a hard job already, writing it and marketing and all that goes into it, and then have this nonsense on top of it. It's just not only unheard of, but it's simply unnecessary, and we got to be able to, put our voices and our foots forward, especially since, and I counsel writers about this all day long, if you want to be able to talk to the world about something, but you can't talk about this, I don't know, are you a writer then, or are you just some idiot putting out a product? Because you're not really fitting in my definition of a writer is somebody that, that had some boldness, that had something interesting and new to say, and if they're willing to combat the evils in the worlds they've created, then they might have to combat the evils in this world sometimes too.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, there's the famous old saying, good men fail when they fail to do something about the evils that rise, and that's a bad paraphrase, but
It's pretty much essentially the truth. And I just try to find the line of reminding people of their responsibility to report this and to talk about it without also sound like I'm beating up a victim, because I'm not. But they do have power and they do have responsibility. And to put that to the side, just because they're not sure about what the you know, the outcome is going to be. It's just, it's not a way we're ever going to be able to tackle it, you know, as people, and not at all.
Agreed. I mean, like I say, it fundamentally gets down to, do you own your power, and do you control your power, or do you give it to someone else?
And that's what you do when you don't report it. You're giving it back to the person, and they've just gotten away with murder, so to speak, and you know there's another slew of people, you know, that's going to be coming down the line. Well, James, thank you very much for being here. A lot of wonderful things to talk about on many subjects, but ultimately, I feel that this show, more than any other show, is about the voice of the writer. And part of that voice is to figure out ways to get your product and your books out there, to learn to be a marketer, to learn to be a promoter, to learn to be some kind of a seller. Because if you can't find your voice beyond after completing that project, well, its future is limited, and in many ways, yours might be too. So definitely try to figure out how to do that. No one says you need to do this overnight. I can't swear to you that if you buy Business Essentials for Writers, that's some kind of going to answer all your questions. But I guarantee you it's going to give you enough of a roadmap that you can start filling in your own gaps and going from there, because that is really your next assignment as a writer. Once you're done with that project, you need to get it out there into people's hands. James, thank you very much for being over here. God bless. I hope to see you again on this show.
Sounds great, Mark. Anytime. And again, I appreciate you having me on. And everybody can feel free to hit me up on social, all that kind of good stuff. Come by, check out authoressentials.net or authoressentialsworkshops.com. If you want the fiction side of me, it's jim-mcdonald.net. Yeah, I'm trying to fix that one. otherwise... Yes, I one of those things you'll find in the book is I've broken every rule in there, so I know which ones are broken. But again, I really appreciate you having me on, and I'll be happy anytime.
God bless, and thank you again.
Thanks much.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.